Ireland Africa. It's Wednesday, the 3rd of April, and you're listening to Game On. Coming up today, Paul Corrie is in studio to talk Premier League. Plus, earlier I sat down with Republic of Ireland manager Eileen Gleeson. We'll bring you that chat ahead of our two huge Euro qualifiers against France and England. In Gaelic games, we're at the business end of the league in Camogie and ladies football, with Aoife Murray and Michelle Ryan coming to talk to us about where things are at, while Damien Lawler will set us up for championship throw-in in Gaelic football. We'll have all of that and more between now and 7. If you want to get in touch, you can text us on 51552. We're on X at GameOn2FM, or you can WhatsApp us on 087 187 9200.
Game On on 2FM.
Welcome along. Paul Corrie is with me in studio. How are you, Paul?
I'm very well, Marie.
Lots of football going on, like this time of year where the midweek games come thick and fast. There's plenty of them, and we'll get into the Premier League ones. But I want to start with the French Cup final, because it's a very unique situation that you have Cork City, former Cork City player Jake O'Brien, in Lyon, playing in a French Cup final, won the semi-final last night. The other semi-final between PSG and Rennes is on tonight, which is absolutely massive, considering 6-8 months, a year ago, before Jake O'Brien moved to Lyon, he wasn't that well known.
No, he wasn't, and he's obviously done very well. He went out on loan to Belgium last year and he did particularly well, came back. And Crystal Palace moved him on to Lyon. To be honest with you, at the beginning of the season, I didn't think he was going to feature a huge amount for Lyon. Just the jump in standard to where he was last year to where he is, and such a household name in French football. But he seems to have been at the forefront of much of what has gone well with Lyon this season. They started the league campaign terribly, and there was uproar with the fans, but they seem to have turned it around in the second half of the season, and he has absolutely been at the forefront of those positive results. And if you just look last night, you know, he's playing in a back four that has Tagliafico, who's playing with Ajax. Nemanja Matic is playing in front of him.
Oh my God.
Lacazette got two last night.
I didn't know they all played. That's amazing.
Like, it's unbelievable. Yeah. Saïd Benrahma playing on the wing. So this
blasts from the past.
Unbelievable. Yeah. This trajectory from Jake O'Brien is massive. I was quite disappointed for him last week, in the sense that he didn't get to feature in either of the games after being called up. But if he continues to play and continues to perform within that team, we want players playing at a high level across European football. He is somebody who's definitely putting his name and a marker down for a centre-half position. The only thing is, it's probably the one position where we have the most strength and depth. But what a story.
Yeah, and even you mentioned the fans there and how they were so unhappy at the start of the season with the club, and there was a lot of abuse being shouted, and they were shown that they were angry, but they seem to really like him.
Yeah, they do. And he features quite prominently on their social media quite a lot. And I'm not sure if you were at the Ireland game against France back in the Euros, were you? The last 16.
No.
That was in Lyon, and the stadium was unbelievable. I was lucky enough to be there, but I can imagine when it's hostile and when things aren't going well, it's probably a difficult atmosphere to play in. So a real test of his character, a test of his ability as a player. But the fact that he's still playing, and he's very much the kind of mainstay from a centre-half point of view, is a real testament to him and the progression that he's had since he left Cork City.
Yeah, and he's shown leadership. He's scoring crucial goals. He's doing a huge amount for them. Let's quickly chat about the Premier.
Sorry, do you know who he's keeping out? Just looking at the team. Dejan Lovren's on the bench. Oh,
that is some collection of stars from the Premier League over the last decade or so. That's amazing. Premier League, so last night, I guess the big one was West Ham and Spurs. You're expecting Spurs to try and close a gap on that top four place, but they just seem to not be able to click in their attack. And Ange Postecoglou was really disappointed. He actually said that he wished he had a joystick to control the Spurs players. Don't all managers wish they'd one of them?
I'm sure they do. Spurs have slightly disappointed me in recent months. If you recall back to the start of the Premier League, they were so quick out of the traps and they won so many games and they were so good going forward, and they were able to combine, I guess, good performance and good results. It seems like in the last couple of weeks and months they've been stop starts, and I know they've had a lot of injuries. Son went to the Asian Cup. Mickey van de Ven at the back has been injured. Romero's been in and out. James Maddison obviously been out as well. But still, there's a part of me that feels that the progression has been good and the performances are definitely getting better, but they still seem so far off Man City and Liverpool in particular, and Arsenal, you have to throw it into that bunch as well. And it feels like they're going to need a big summer of investment, because that gap for me is still there. I mean, they exited out of the last 16 of the FA Cup against Man City. I was very critical of Postecoglou with the side that he put out in the Carabao Cup, because I just feel with Tottenham, they need to win something at some period in time. It's been so long, and you know, would finishing in the top five behind Aston Villa be a great season? I don't really know, Marie.
Well, when you look at Liverpool, Arsenal and Man City are ahead of them. Like, if they moved into fourth, then that probably could see
fourth. Yeah, fourth would be positive, but then you have to contend with Champions League football. You have to invest in the squad, because it does feel trim that any time one of those key players drops out, they don't be able to seem to be able to sustain the same level of performance. So I don't really know where I sit in Tottenham. I think Postecoglou's doing a fantastic job, don't get me wrong. Harry Kane leaving the building, such a difficult job to turn things around and get back the fans on side and get a playing style that's more in line with the way the club and the fans want to play. But there's still a part of me that goes, they're a bit weak. They're still a bit weak. And if they were to finish, say, behind Aston Villa, you look at the teams that they finish above, maybe Manchester United, Newcastle and Chelsea are teams that maybe you would expect would have challenged them for that top five. I'm not really too sure. And that result last night against a West Ham team who've been stop-start themselves, it's not great. And maybe if they could finish the season strong and finish top four, that's great momentum to build upon. But I still think there's a fragility at the spine of that team.
Can you throw Newcastle into that same kind of bracket of teams that had showed so much promise, but they didn't seem to be able to fulfill the potential they had?
Yeah, potentially.
Everton last night, 1-1.
Yeah, the game against Everton was probably a good sort of benchmark of how the season has gone. They could have been and should have been two ahead when they went 1-0 up. They had a number of chances to put Everton to bed and they just weren't able to put them away. And unfortunately, they're missing so many key players that the game somewhat got away from them and they allowed Everton to get back into the game. Whereas if you go back 12 months, they were just putting those games to bed and they weren't letting teams get back into it. And the foul from Dummett on Ashley Young to give away the penalty was just unforgivable. Like, it's one of those situations that maybe pre-VAR you get away with because there's a lot of manhandling going on in the box, but Dummett literally wraps his arms around Ashley Young, drags him to the floor and gives away a penalty late on in the 88th minute. And Dominic Calvert-Lewin, who's been without a goal for so long, just about put a pass to Bravka, and that's a vital point for Everton. But it's somewhat worrying times for Newcastle, just because I think the Saudis are so impatient. They want success. Last year they were way ahead of the curve from where they should be based on the squad they have. He's had so many injuries to contend with. I just worry that if Eddie Howe was to get off to a slow start at the beginning of next season, where would the patience lie with the Saudis? Yeah. But he's certainly got enough credit in the bank for now.
Yeah, I don't know, I'd be very surprised if he's still there when next season starts. Huge win for Nottingham Forest over Fulham last night, 3-1.
Yeah, big win, and it's a big win for a number of reasons, but I guess when you take that points deduction into consideration, Forest, Luton and Everton are the three teams that I see as really fighting out for that final relegation spot to stay away from. 5 points in the last three games from Forest, so it's good sort of momentum that they're taking into these last 8 or 9 games, and you would imagine their home form is going to be really important, but still bang in it. Home form, scoring goals, really, really important for Forest. And you feel like if they could just win and create a bit of a gap from Luton, you might have a situation where it's just too much to recover. But yeah, those sort of games are massive for Nottingham Forest. And Fulham sort of have the feeling that the flip-flops are on and the players are heading to the beach, because they're very much in a safe position in the Premier League.
So this evening we have Arsenal in action against Luton, Man City against Aston Villa, Liverpool on tomorrow against Sheffield United. It does feel like now, you know, we're on that home stretch that everything is tense.
It does, and without stating the obvious, Arsenal have to win tonight. Like, if you look at the fixtures,
every team has to win every game.
Yeah, but if you look at the fixtures of Arsenal and Man City over the next fortnight, Arsenal play Luton at home tonight, then they go to Brighton away on the weekend, then they play Bayern Munich at home, Villa at home, yeah, Bayern away, and then Wolves away. So I think you'll get a really clear sort of snapshot of where Arsenal are going to compete over this next fortnight, because maybe if they were to go out of the Champions League but win their league games, you give them a bit more of a clear run into the end of the Premier League. But while they're having to balance the two, there's a lot of juggling going on. I don't think Arteta really uses more than sort of 12 or 13 players, whereas Pep tends to rotate the squad a bit more. There's going to be a massive ask on those players to churn out results over the space of 2, 3, 4 days. The travel that you have to take into consideration as well, it's just going to pull on them in so many different directions. And if they were to compete and go further in the Champions League, that's going to continue on. But I feel there's a real sort of test come Arsenal's way. There's a kind of a black mark over them based on how they finished the season last year. I know Saliba came out of the squad and the wheels seemed to fall off. There seems to be a bit more sturdiness and there seems to be a bit more steel, particularly with Declan Rice in the middle of the park. questions there. I think we'll get a lot of answers over the next fortnight, but absolutely expect them to be Luton at home.
What did you think of Pep Guardiola responding to Roy Keane's criticism of Erling Haaland?
Was that? Do you think that had something to do with Keane and Haaland's father?
I was thinking about it, but like I can understand that there has always been criticism about Haaland's play. Well, particularly maybe at the start of the season about his all-round general play. Now, he obviously takes it too far, but that's the way Roy Keane does. And maybe he was waiting and hoping that he would have an opportunity to say, oh, he's not the perfect player. And he went in with the two feet, literally, as he's done before. But Guardiola then responded and said he was a League 2, League 3 manager, I think it was what he said.
Well, Haaland's still only, like, he's just gone 23. So there still is a lot of development left in his game. I think people are a little too critical of Haaland's general play. I think if you look back at situations where he's actually had space to work with and, you know, space to run into, I think he shows a little more in his general play. I mean, if I think back, it was a game against Everson where he left Braithwaite for dead and he just out-muscled him. But then that, some of that was to do with his close control and his coordination. I think people are a little critical. If you put the majority of centre-forwards into that tight little space that Haaland has to play into, where teams play a low buck, there's a bank of four midfielders and then there's centre-halves, and he literally has 2-3 yards to keep the ball tight and keep it under control. And yes, he can improve on it at different times, but I think people are quick to jump in on him when it doesn't go right. His goals will still be the key thing that people measure him on. I would be a little more worried if he wasn't getting into those positions and he wasn't in a situation to benefit on those chances that are created for Man City. I think he's in those positions, he's still getting those chances, and it's just a matter of time before he scores. And my prediction would be that Man City win tonight and Haaland scores, because he's just got such good character to bounce back from difficult moments.
Yeah, it's a bit like the way we look at young people, and he probably doesn't know who Roy Keane was, you know what I mean? As in, like, it's one of those things where it'll probably just bounce off him because he is, as you said,
he seems
early
bulletproof,
20s.
Doesn't he?
Yeah,
he does seem bulletproof.
Like, things like that won't care.
He's still top goal scorer in the Premier League.
Like, I can imagine him looking at the analysis sometimes, you know, when it descends into chaos and like who are these guys kind of thing. Anyway, we're going to move on from the Premier League. This week, Paul, I sat down with Eileen Gleeson just to have a chat about these two huge European qualifiers, France on Friday and England on Tuesday. Tough one to be heading into. What do you think?
It's very difficult. I mean, the group is honestly so, so hard to see where we're going to get a win, and points are going to be difficult to come by. But at the same time, the trajectory of this squad, the belief that exists within, I think we can put performances together, and whether or not we're able to get results off the back of it, I'm not too sure. But I think we'll learn a lot about the squad. We'll learn a lot about Eileen and how she wants to set up and some of the personnel that she's going to use. But we need to, I guess, really be at it. We can't have a situation that we have a performance like we did against Wales, because we'll get torn apart against opposition like France and England. So it's absolutely about getting things correct tactically, and then you hope that players are able to go out and produce and stick to a game plan and make ourselves difficult to play against. And then you hope that the likes of a Denise or a Katie can, you know, keep control of possession, hope that Caruso doesn't get too isolated up the top end of the pitch. But it's about how we constrict the opposition first and foremost, because this is top, top opposition that we're playing against.
Okay, well, to be fair, she seemed really positive about the challenge that is coming down the track. Let's hear from Eileen Gleeson.
Game on.
Football.
So tell me a little bit about your journey into coaching.
Yeah, so I suppose I was always into sport. I had all brothers, so you're always playing with a ball out the backyard, and then there wasn't a girls team in my area when I was growing up, so you had to go outside to play. So I started off playing in the civil service and then ended up actually on a FOS course, a coaching course, the gap between going to college and finishing the Leaving Cert, and started into my coaching journey on that programme. And yeah, just kind of went from there, from playing into the coaching, and it was kind of, you know, maybe it's because I was a better coach than a better player, but yeah, so it felt really natural, and went from there, Ballymun United, James's Gate, Piemont, and just here I am now.
So, like, tell me a little bit about that. Like, was there opportunities given to you at every turn, or did you have to fight for them?
Yeah, I don't think anything was given. You know, it was, I was always the only female on the coach education programmes. that was fine for me. Everybody was supportive within that environment. But yeah, you had to work extra hard to get onto the course. You had to, you know, it was always a point you were the only female. Yeah, and you had to prove yourself double in a way. Of course, I was completely committed to the women's game. But yeah, challenges, you know, that you'll hear across the board from women around perceptions of female coaches, perceptions of the women's game within clubs. And it was a growing, as you said, and you mentioned earlier, it was a growing sport. So you had to push for a lot of basic resources for the women's team. And then as a coach, you know, anything I've done has been self-funded. So while I started off on that, the FORCE programme, then it was the A licence, then it was the Pro licence, then the educational aspect. I mean, I would have self-funded all of those programmes, and yeah, because I wanted to be as good as I could be with the team and for the players. So yeah, it's definitely not given, but I think within the challenges that you have, you have to become resourceful. So I didn't do it on my own. There was a lot of good people around as well that, you know, were true supporters and true advocates for women's football as well. And, you know, they're still in the game today, and that's what's helped the game grow, and it's what's helped me grow as a coach and as a person then, and as someone that is within women's football.
The perception used to be, I don't think it's anymore, that if you were a successful coach that you had to go into the men's game to prove that.
Yeah.
Were you ever tempted, or was it always the women's game?
No, it was always the women's game. And yeah, I mean, I've heard many female coaches ask, you know, oh, do you want to, you know, who are in senior positions of women's game, and asked, oh, you might step into a junior position in the men's game, and it's as if it's a promotion, you know, that you're going into the men's game. But I never had any you know, desires to go into the men's game. It was always about trying to raise the standards in the women's game, and was totally committed to the women's game. So all of my experience then is in the women's game, by choice. So yeah, I've always been a strong supporter of the women's game, and that was really where my core interests are and still are.
It's amazing, really, when you think that when you were starting out, Eileen, you probably couldn't see that pathway to where you are now, but you kept going and going, and it sounds like it nearly opened up in front of you.
Yeah, and I think when you're in it, you're just day to day, and you're with that team, you're working with them. Are you thinking about your 10-year plan? Probably not, even if people are, you know, asking you, I don't know about that questions. But I always knew when it was finished, one piece of education development you wanted to do. I was always curious and wanted to keep doing more. I think if you look at my experience or my profile, it is all essentially in Irish football. And people would always ask me along the way, why don't you go off to the US? Why don't you go off here? But I wanted to develop Irish football and had a real commitment to Irish football. And I remember someone saying to me before about my CV, you didn't show much ambition. And that was because I was in Irish football. And I had to, you know, stop before I answered it, and I said, oh, maybe you should reframe that as a loyalty and a commitment to Irish football. And okay, the infrastructures need to develop, we all know that, we need more resources, we need to build capacity, but it doesn't mean you're any lesser of a coach. It doesn't mean that the qualifications I pursued are any lesser, or, you know, it's a commitment to Irish football, and I think I always felt that, and so here I am now.
You must have seen a lot of potential there, though, to keep so loyal to it.
Yeah, you'd see the progressions. You'd see the level of work that the clubs do, the volunteers do, the efforts that players put in, you know, and the demands that was on them as an amateur setup, and you know, as a growing infrastructure, which is still growing. But yeah, I mean, I remember, you know, the Champions League with Piemont United. I mean, no one thought we were going to qualify out of a group, us included. I mean, we were greener than the grass, and we went, and then we had to play PSG in the knockout round. And were they better than us? Yeah, they were better than us, but they didn't. The differences were fitnesses and the last 15, 20 minutes. So you could always see the potential there and the potential that the players had, and you would always hope for a better wraparound infrastructure and better resources that you could develop the players more, and then you could really show, you know, if we added those, where could we compete? So yes, it's a lot to do with the domestic game, and that's progression, and we've got some professionalisation, we've got the League of Ireland, and then you can, I think we're really starting to see the progression at international level, and yes, other countries are growing, and the game has grown exponentially on a global basis, but I think you're seeing our growth now, and I mean, we're seeing it now, we're League A, we see different challenges, but we're going in there with the absolute aim to compete, and I think, yeah, so when you're in it, you're hoping for that growth, you see the potential, and you're hoping that everything else can move along with it to help you get there.
What kind of a head coach are you?
I mean, in the first instance, I'd like to think I'm approachable and open, I think, you know, with staff, and this is an evolution, because I think as a coach and as a person, you evolve throughout the years. So when I started off, I didn't have any staff, had any me, and she's still there. And I did all the coaching, every single session, and she didn't want to coach, so she'd do everything else. And like we were, and still are, a great team. But as you move on, now we've got 20 staff. So for us, we talk about this interdisciplinary team. For me, people having autonomy is a real value. I mean, I've been in environments where you weren't allowed to do anything, and it's soul destroying. You know, if you want to express yourself, and if we bring people in, and coaching staff, technical staff, performance staff, they've got the expertise there, then they get to, you know, show that and deliver on that. So I feel as a coach or as a head coach, I'm definitely open to promoting that kind of an environment with the players as well. We have good open discussions. We can talk about the tactics. I mean, I've got some great assistants, Emma, Reese, Colin now. So well, yeah, let them perform their role. Let them have autonomy in that. Not let them, but that's the environment it is. It's they're going to get to express themselves in their role. So, yeah, I'd like to think that I'm open with that, that I promote that autonomy across the staff and with the players, that as a coaching style and as setting up that environment, that we work off a principles base that allows for freedom within a context. So, well, it's the people you're interacting with. And look, you'll have many moments where there's clashes, but it's... Yeah, it's trying to drive that open communication, but you have to crack and you have to highs and lows, and it's being measured in that. But yeah, there's great excitement in it if something comes off. But yeah, I think it's all the planning and the detail, and it really is the people that are involved in it. I mean, some of my best moments in football are not about the football. They're about a player that, you know, got to the international team, or a player came back after an injury or an illness, and they're the moments that you remember, and they're about people.
One of the things that's came up in the past few weeks is relationships within setups. Do you have a view on that?
Do I have a view? Listen, we have views on you know, everything as a coach. You know, do relationships potentially, you know, change dynamics? Yes, they do, but they're also a feature. So you do have to. You do have to be able to manage it. You do have to have, you know, your boundaries within what that looks like within a team environment. And, you know, people in relationships have to have an awareness of, you know, the potential impacts that can have, because in a dressing room, it's a small environment. There's lots of dynamics. Yeah, so, yeah, they are a feature. And it is just managing boundaries and behaviours around what that looks like in a team setting, I think.
We're going to be heading into a new campaign.
Yeah.
Very soon. It's exciting. Some big nations coming to town. How are you feeling about it?
Yeah, I mean, look, it's super exciting. The draw gave us all a good... it was an interesting day. It was... I think if you were looking at the draw, that was always potentially... You know, what could happen? Did we want it to happen? No. Realistically, did anybody else in the group want it to happen? No, it's not just us. But here's where we are, and in the camper, and we do have this phrase, and we have it with staff, and we say, you know, is be where your feet are. So promote that. This is where we are. How are we going to approach it? You know, the very first media engagement I had after the draw, they're like, oh, at least you have the playoff. I was thinking, wow, like, we're not going to go there now, right? We're going to talk about we're in this group and how are we going to try to compete in this group, and is it a challenge? Absolutely. But, you know, if you talk to us about who our identity is, you know, the players, we have some characteristics that we talk about, and with different games and this group particularly, we'll emphasise some of, you know, you'll emphasise different parts of those characteristics, like hard to beat. And, you know, we'll be realistic within it. We're up against third, fourth and fifth in the world. So nobody's making excuses, but nobody's going to be unrealistic. And we'll look to emphasise different parts of ourselves then to get us, you know, within the best chance within those games. So, yeah, it's challenging. It's exciting, but it is where we are, and we'll definitely be super positive in it.
Game on.
Football.
Eileen Gleeson there speaking to me during the week. So those huge games between Ireland and France and Ireland and England coming up over the next few days. Well, she's trying to be positive about it, and like, what else can you be heading into the challenge that she faces? Is it a case that it's going to be three centre-backs, two wing-backs and try and be hard to beat?
Well, I think first and foremost with Eileen, her passion always comes through when she speaks about the job and when she speaks about Irish football. And she certainly seems like somebody who will empower the staff in order to perform the job, and also she will give belief to that squad. So, yeah, listen, the squad will go in, I'm sure, with loads of hope and belief, but I'm sure there'll be a real sense of realism about how they're going to approach that game. And you would expect it'll probably be the three centre-halves with the two wing-backs and two centre midfielders, and just try get a really good foundation to build upon and to be difficult to play against. And that is what's got us success and results in the past. So why would you deviate too much away from that when you're playing these bigger nations? Good thing is we've played France in the warm-up for the World Cup. A lot of the players will be playing against that English opposition in the WSL. So you would hope there's a bit of familiarity and people won't be fazed by the opposition that we have to go up against. But it's such a stiff task against both of those teams. And you would hope that we get a good performance and hopefully a point out of either game, I think, be a huge, huge result.
I know she doesn't want to talk about the playoff yet because she's all these games to play beforehand, and that's understandable. As a player, are those the games you want to play though, Paul?
Oh, they are. And she doesn't want to talk about the playoff, but we do have to keep that in the back of our mind. We have that safety net. Yeah, we have that safety net. We have that cushion because of our good performances in the Nations League. And that will obviously give us a great opportunity to qualify for another major competition. But I think if you're a player, particularly one of the younger players who are coming into camp, or maybe somebody who's just in their first couple of caps for Ireland, you want to be playing against top opposition. You want to put yourself in those situations and test yourself and see how you get on and see if you can perform and put yourself in the shop window. And I think for a number of our players who have done well in the Irish shirt over the last number of years, I think they'll fancy themselves, at least testing themselves against those top teams. Whether or not we get a result, it's very hard to say, and it's very hard to sit here and say, yeah, we'll definitely get a result against France or England just because they're such top teams. But I think what we've always got from this team is performances, and I would expect that we get two positive performances from Eileen's side.
Okay, well, those two huge games are, of course, on 2FM, so do tune in on Friday evening and Tuesday evening for them, and they will be on RTÉ television as well. We're going to take a very quick break, but do stay with us. We'll be chatting to Damian Lawler about the start of the Gaelic Football Championship. Hard to believe it's here, but it is here, and we'll also be looking ahead to the Lidl Women's Gaelic Football finals in Croke Park this weekend, plus the Camogie from last weekend, and looking ahead to that Division 1 final as well.
2FM.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back to Game On. Now this week sees Championship throw-in of Gaelic football. So who better to set us up for it all than Damian Lawler, presenter of the Championship over on RTÉ Radio 1, which returns to the airwaves this Friday night at 10 o'clock. Before we chat to Damian, one of the early staples of the Connacht Championship is an away trip to London. They welcome Galway to Ruislip, and Damian has been speaking to London manager Michael Maher. But first, here's Galway coach John Concannon on the Galway forward line showing glimpses of hope in the league despite a very long list of absences.
there was patches of good forward play, but all through the 70 games it was only patches, and we're not stupid enough to not to realise that. Look, again, go back to the experience the young lads have gotten in the first few games, and when the senior lads come back, like, you know, the Matties, the Damies, the Shanes, even Killy McDade, like, hopefully the forward play it'll become more consistent rather than just patches.
When would you hope to have a lot of these guys back?
Well, look, Pádraig, I think, went on record to say he's hoping Sean Kelly, and we're hoping Sean Kelly will be fit for the London game just to take part. The rest of the lads, because it's touch and go, it's week by week. Okay. At one stage we had 21 injuries, so we couldn't, like, literally train. It was like a seven-a-side game. Like, it's everything. It's a split season, it's so many games that, like, some of the, you know, the elite players are playing club football up to the end of the year and then coming back in. Like, we had two or three injuries coming back from the club games, with two or three coming back from Sigerson games. The split season to me is not conducive for the preparation of the intercounty season.
We picked up a great win against Mayo in the FBD League, a good performance against Roscommon in the FBD semi-final, which kind of gave us a flavour of where you'd need to be against Division 1 teams. The speed of those games was incredible, but look, nothing matches the hustle and bustle of Division 4 National League football. We contested and competed very, very well in a lot of games. The Wexford game at the start, we started the game ever so well. Wexford got on top of us and got the result. Performances built game by game against Leitrim, we performed really well. Tipperary, we were going on to probably win the game fairly comfortably when our main forward on the day, Cahill Lacey, got a bad injury, unfortunately broke his tibia. He just hit 3 points in a row, got injured, stalled our momentum in that game. But look, we still come out of a draw, which probably kick-started a little bit of belief in the group. We got the win against Waterford, underperformed in another couple of games. But look, we know we're going to make massive improvements now coming into the summer months. Once we get training on football pitches in daylight, Championship football is where it's at. We made it our goal from the start of the year that we wanted a Championship win this year. Whether that comes in the Connacht Championship or the Tautian Cup, who knows? We hope there'll be a good crowd in at Ruislip on Saturday. It's a great occasion for all Gaels across London to come together and celebrate Gaelic games on the day.
Now, that was London manager Michael Marr. Damien, a big one for both teams, given Galway's injury profile and just that little bit of excitement around London.
Yeah, 100%, Marie. In fairness to Michael Maher, he's done a fine job with London. Like, up to a few years ago, they might have got maybe 1 point per National League campaign, but Michael has them nearly up to the 3, 4, 5, 6 point mark. And even a couple of years ago, they started off winning 3 games in the trot. He's a really sharp manager. Like, if he ever comes back to these shores, I think he'd be fairly well snapped up. But the Galway situation has just been nuts. Like, at one stage, they had 4 All-Stars missing, but 21 players in total. And I remember we covered them on TV Sport a few weeks back against the Dubs, I think. And on that day, they had 15 players rehabbing in the gym. So it's been miserable, really, for them. Now, they have uncovered new talent and probably new forwards, you know, McCabe, these guys. But the likes of Johnny McGrath at the back has been a revelation again, too. But still, though, 21 players. It just goes to show what they could possibly achieve if they had the band back together. And we're waiting to see now if Sean Kelly will play against London at the weekend, Marie. That's a big one. But, you know, that'll be one that both London, both Galway on Saturday and Mayo on Sunday will just be happy to fly back to Ireland with a Connacht Championship quarter-final win under their belt. They can be sticky enough, okay?
Yeah. Yeah, they absolutely can. You mentioned there Mayo heading off to New York. I know there's been a little bit of, yeah, I suppose, poking fun at them going off on their little break, but it's a big one for them as well. Gaelic Park, the adventure, and if things can go right, which they generally do over there, but it does kind of help with bonding and getting everything going for the season ahead.
Yeah, look, it's an early start. And I mean, at the end of the day, they did well in the league. They did as well as they had to do. Winning the league last year didn't do them any use whatsoever. They got beaten 1 week later in the championship. This time out, they go to play a New York squad that I think roughly 12 of the squad are homegrown. We mentioned there London giving 15 debuts. A lot of the London players are homegrown too, but there is more traffic from this country over there. Not as much as in recent years over in New York. What an emphasis they're putting on underage, right down from nursery under 7 to Fela, but to under 17 development squads and even colleges as well. So more and more New York teams coming over here to play either tournaments or exhibition games or championship games as well, Marie. So I expect New York will give Mayo a bit of it. I can't see them winning that game. I think they'll get a second game in the Tauchan Cup then. And there's no reason why they can't win the Tauchan Cup game and get to play a third championship game this year. That would realistically have to be the aim for New York. As regards Mayo, I just think they need to settle on a style. I think at times they look fairly the more direct and the more chaotic that they play, the more impactful that they are, in my own opinion. And I think while they have to look after the defence, when they do attack and they're in free flow, that's what suits Mayo football. So if they can stick to those principles and go, I suppose, helter-skelter for as long as they possibly can, they're a top-tier team, but, you know, not quite sure where they are this year yet. The league didn't give us too many answers on that either, like, you know.
We saw Leitrim in action last weekend in the league final, Westmeath as well. I guess we'll tell what whether or not getting to league finals are beneficial maybe after this weekend as well, Damien.
Yeah, I think there's a lot to be said for that, Marie. Like, you're looking at Westmeath got promoted in the Allianz League there just a few weeks ago, and they play at Wicklow. They play in Port Leash on Sunday at 3:30. So the big story there is, you know, the likes of Sam McCartan, where he's probably one of the most informed players in the country. They will fancy their chances of beating Wicklow, but will Mark Jackson be back playing for Wicklow? Mark Jackson is a goalkeeper, scored 100 points for them in history books. Spent the last few months out in the NFL, trying to land a contract with an American football team. Did quite well in the University of Florida, nailed 7 out of 10 kicks. Stylish kicker. He returned back to the Wicklow squad last Saturday. So his presence now after missing the Allianz League was a huge boost to everybody. But after they got relegated and Westmeath got promoted, you'd imagine there's only one result there. But you can't underestimate what could happen if Mark Jackson is on that pitch. I know he's just in one position, but he exudes calm throughout that field. So I expect Westmeath to push on, but just watch out for Mark Jackson if he's playing.
Yeah, definitely. It's a brilliant story. Any of the rest of the lads who headed over close to getting contracts?
Well, I mean, yeah, I'd say, like, and again, you've got the Ulster Championship game on Sunday in Clonus, Marie, Monaghan versus Cavan, a Cavan team that maybe tucked in nicely in their own division, and then you've got Monaghan, who got relegated from the top tier for the first time in 10 years. By all accounts, Rory Began is back training there, Marie, a bit like Mark Jackson. He nailed 10 out of 10 kicks in the second combine trial in the University of Florida. Excuse me, the previous combine trial, I think he nailed 8. And I think they're really, really impressed with Rory. So my information was that Rory is in a really good place. But he's home now. And I think at any stage over the next few months, they can be contacted by NFL clubs. So certainly, I think there's no doubt he wants to make it. Charlie Smith has already shown the way. But if Rory's there against Cavan, in Clonus on Sunday, a crowd of over 10,000 people expected at that. That'd be a major talking point too. It'll be Ray McGalligan's first championship outing as Cavan manager as well, Marie. They did a lot of things right during the league. They got caught in one or two areas as well. So could they be in a position maybe to rattle a Monaghan side that might just be bereft of a little bit of confidence? But you'd imagine Vinnie Corey will have galvanised his men up there for a home win. Then just as regards back to the Leinster Championship, Marie, you've got Wexford and Carlow. That's in Chadwick's Wexford Park. John Hegarty's done a fine job. Wexford got 10 points in Division 4 and still they can get promoted. And now they're playing against the Carlow side. That will enough too. They got 8 points as far as I can recall. But Jordan Morrissey, their main player, has gone off travelling to the States. That's a massive, massive blow to Carlow, Marie. And it's a dilemma and a problem that's being faced by lower tier counties, not just at the start of the season, but maybe after the league as well, if things aren't maybe, you know, people have, mm-hmm. young people have their own plans, travel plans. So George Morrissey's a massive loss there as well. And then really the other game in Leinster is Longford versus Meath. That's in Pierce Park at 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock, sorry. And I suppose the main talking point there, Longford probably huffed and puffed towards promotion. Meath haven't really kicked on since the Tailteann Cup win. Did they need to, because their championship place was already guaranteed? You'd expect Meath to have a serious response there. So I think, look, Leinster football totally dominates Dublin, are the champions. They're looking for 14 in a row. It's not an ideal situation for any province.
Could you say the same about Munster and Kerry?
Yeah, like I still hold out hope that a functioning Cork team could do something there, could push Kerry at the very least. Your own county in Clare, I'm really, really happy as a Tipperary man even to see what, because, you know, for the weaker counties to keep up to a certain level is very, very hard. But Colm Collins had developed good young talent and Mark Fitzgerald has done a great job. So I think Clare are up to a really good level. Cork have shown glimpses of what they can achieve. Limerick and Tipperary and Waterford are probably not going well at the moment. So it'll be up to...
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back. We are turning our attention to women's Gaelic football. The Lidl ladies, the Lidl finals are on this weekend in Croke Park. I'm delighted to say that Waterford legend Michelle Ryan joins us. How are you, Michelle?
I'm great, Marie. Thanks very much. How are you?
Good, yeah. Looking forward to this one. Armagh and Kerry, you don't think you're going to see them that often, but yet they seem to be popping up together quite a bit, and kind of familiar foes almost, meeting in the Division 2 decider in 2022 and, of course, earlier this year as well. What are you expecting from this one, Michelle?
Yeah, you're right. They've come across each other a lot in the last 2 years especially. And I suppose Kerry have a good record in Croke Park and league finals, maybe not so much in championship, but definitely in league finals over the last 2 years, winning the Division 2 in 2002 against Armagh, Division 1 comprehensively last year against Galway. And then I suppose Armagh are coming in with a lot of momentum, seeing as after that loss in 2022 in the league final against Kerry, they won the Division 2 league final against Leash last year, and they have really just flown through the Division 1 league right up until that last game. And I don't think we can analyse that last game. They were already qualified for the league final, a very heavy loss to Dublin. 9 or 10 changes, I think, in the starting team. But up until that point, they really had been flying and firing on all cylinders, especially in attack. And I think they're coming in with very different perspectives, Marie. I think like Kerry management from the get-go in the league have been eager to say, you know, the All-Ireland is really their focus this year. You know, they've had the league success in the last 2 years. They've tasted a little bit of silverware. They've lost to All-Ireland, and that really has been their focus. And we see with maybe the amount of players they've been using throughout the league as well, that it really is about that depth in the panel and trying to settle on not just a starting 15, but a finishing 15 as well for later in the year. But with Armagh, I think it's just about keeping that momentum going and really going from strength to strength. They haven't been making as many changes in each game as Kerry have been, and I think they're coming in with a nice bit of power behind them and a nice bit of confidence, and I think it's going to make a very interesting battle. And even though Kerry, I suppose, have said their focus later in the year, like no player is going into this Sunday with not wanting to win this game, and whatever the perspective will be, whatever the results will be afterwards, that's another day's story. But I don't know, I'm slightly fancying our memory, to be honest, I think.
Yeah, it's definitely an interesting one. And I think when you look on paper as well, and the teams that they have, and the strengths, they both have brilliant individual players, but yet seem to know what they're about in terms of the way that they play as well. But Kerry probably come under the spotlight just a little bit more, because you would think they're a little bit more advanced on their development, just given how well they did last year, albeit not getting over that final hurdle. But still, are you seeing an evolution within that team?
Oh, definitely. I think that what they've done in the last 2 years has been quite remarkable. And having been as a lot of their games, I mean, it's hard to describe, and it's not something that's very kind of tangible or measurable, but you can feel that unity that was within the group after they finished their games, the way they communicate with each other, the way they communicate with everybody else. There really is that cohesion among them. I think that really is down to Declan Quill and Dara Long and what they've brought into that. And players have come back, you know, for Kerry because of the taste of success over the last 2 years, and there really is that belief within them that they can do something. And I think they are very much looking at that big picture. But look, another medal on the table and another chance of the trophy on Sunday is obviously going to help that. But I do think there has been a massive evolution in Kerry when you think back even to where they were 5-6 years ago to where they are now. So look, I think they'll be coming in with plenty of confidence and belief because they have the depth and players. I think maybe their experimentation over the last few weeks. Well, they have ground out some victories. They have ground out really tough victories at times. I think maybe just the stage of the year that they're at, I'm not sure if they're entirely settled just yet. It will happen. Absolutely, it will come. I think Armagh probably are just a little bit more settled for this time of the year.
Yeah, I really like the Armagh story as well. Just getting into Division 1, they've obviously seen what has happened with the likes of Meath before, and that they know that, as you said, the momentum is hugely important. But there seems like there's a real buzz about them, even at home in their county. They're getting a huge amount of support.
There, and you're right. I think when Meath won that All-Ireland, it really did so much for ladies football all over the country, to be honest. I don't think we can even take any of that for granted, because the journey that Kerry came on after that, the journey, like you said, now there are Mar coming on, and other counties as well, that the belief that, you know, on any given day, I mean, you only have to take actually a look at the Division 4 final, which is going to take place on Saturday. you had the Carlo and Limerick both finished in position 3 and 4 in the league going into semi-finals, and both with 2 last-minute goals on both semi-finals managed to beat those who were sitting division in the position 1 Fermanagh and 2 in Leitrim. And it just goes to show, this time of the year, anything can happen on any given day. Once you play on the day, and I know it's a cliche, I hate using it, but on the day, once you play to your full potential, I mean, anything can really happen. And that's the beauty of this time of year as well. And the beauty then as well is, if you have that victory, the momentum it can bring with you into championship is huge. And I suppose we're used to the last number of years in the senior championship, especially seeing the same kind of eight teams come out into the quarterfinal stage. And for a long period there, we were able to more or less guess who was going to be semi-final and final. But we've just had a few surprises in the last 3 or 4 years, which is great, and great for ladies football.
And just for the matchups, what do you think are going to be the key ones, Michelle?
Well, look, I mean, probably the player of the league so far, or right up there with him, is Amy Mackin. Everybody knows her. She's a household name at this stage. She's leading scorer in the league, both from play and from in total. She scored 6.21 in matches to date. And there's been a few matches where, when they were put to the pin of their collar, and she comes out scoring 2 goals in the second half, actually in their win over Kerry, when Kerry is starting to come back in. So whoever decides to take up Amy Mackin, I mean, we know she's incredibly hard to handle. But it's not just one player there. It's going to have to be that real block defence. And Kerry are good at that. Kerry are good at getting back there. But I just think she is obviously the key player for Emma. How you stop her, I mean, that's, I don't know if anybody in the country can manage to do that either. But also on the other side then as well, you have the likes of Emma Deneen, who really has come into the Kerry setup as well from the start of this league. Really has been impressive. You also have the likes of Nivni Krahur in the half-forward line. The Kerry half-forward line has been crucial, I feel, in the last 2 years. And while we always, I suppose, you look to the score-getters naturally, but the work that they do going up and down the field, and Armagh will really have to track that. And they go very, very deep to get on the ball. They look up to the likes of Louisa Mayer-Herzig inside, Danielle O'Leary, and supply it very quickly. So whoever is on the Kerry half-forward line will really have to be very aware of their positioning on the pitch and trying to cut out the supply as quick as possible. So I think, to be honest, it is going to be a game where the defences are going to be incredibly important, because you have sharpshooters on both sides.
Okay, sounds like it's going to be an absolute cracker, and no doubt no team is going to want to lose any big game in Croke Park. Michelle Ryan, thank you so much for joining us. We're turning our attention now to Camogie, and Aoife Murray joins us as always on a Wednesday. How are things, Aoife?
Yeah, really good, really good. Good to be here chatting about Camogie.
Absolutely, especially now that we know who is going to be in the league final. So a novel pairing when you look at Tipperary and their trajectory over the last few years, playing Galway, who are going for the 3 in a row. But good to see Tipperary there, and to know that that top table doesn't have the same people sitting around it so much anymore, Aoife.
Yeah, look, and it was probably something I even said to Shane last week. I think Marie was... I suppose we've had these conversations, I don't know how many years now, with regard to the top three, and, you know, wishing and willing somebody to go and kind of break into the top three. And I think certainly we've probably been chatting about Tipperary a good bit over the last couple of years, that semi-final kind of glass ceiling that they just can't seem to break with regard to the championship. They've certainly broken it now in the league, which I think can only be a positive for looking to the championship. Look, as a neutral, Marie, I'm absolutely delighted that Tipperary have got there and they've broken into that top three. It's hard now to even pick a top two, top three, top four, etc. As a Cork woman, I'd be very worried.
Yeah.
Very worried to see them back. But certainly for the game at Camogie, I think it's well needed, and I think it can only be a massive positive for the game.
Yeah, so that league final is on the 14th of April in Croke Park, and it'll be Galway and Tipperary. But just your reflections in general now that we're coming to the end of the league, Aoife.
Yeah, and it's, I thought it was quite an entertaining league in the sense of, you know, Waterford were top for a while, Cork were there, then Galway were there, you know, so there was a huge amount of changes to the table, which, look, if we're honest with each other, that hasn't happened, and it's something that we have, as I said, we've wished for so long. So that part of the league, I think, was really entertaining. There was a lot of goals, some really good high-scoring games. and teams that you could see that they were trying to build something for the championship, that they were really using it, one, to blood players. There were some new managers, you could see them were trying to get use of new players coming in, maybe some of the older players within the panel. So there was, it was hugely interesting and entertaining in that sense. Look, unfortunately as well, though, the weather hasn't been the greatest, so a lot of the games, you know, no team could get into a proper flow, and I think that was probably one of the down points with regards to the league. Was, you know, if you take Cork and Galway at the weekend, Marie, like, that should have been a cracker, right? Cork had to go and win the game, but it was so heavy underfoot, like basics of the game, picking the ball, first touch. Like, at this latter end of the competition, you would think they would start to come a lot easier, but it was just so hard to get the basics right, whether it was the wind or the actual condition of the pitches, which I know for a lot of teams has been really hard. A lot of teams haven't been even able to train out on the pitches. So I think that was one of the points where you couldn't really see exactly where a lot of the teams were. But if you had said last year that Kilkenny would be, you know, second bottom in the league, you'd wonder who else was ahead of them. So I think that in itself, I think, was a real positive league campaign for Camogie, and hopefully signs to come for the championship.
Yeah, absolutely. Aoife Murray, as always, thank you so much. And there's lots to look forward to with the Camogie over the next few months, starting with that league final on the 14th of April. That is all we have time for. Paul Carey, thank you so much, as always, for coming in to studio. Shane is back tomorrow. Aoife did mention the bad weather, and unfortunately it's supposed to get really bad this weekend with the storm coming, which doesn't bode very well for the hurling final between Clare and Kilkenny. But Shane will be previewing it tomorrow, so do tune in for that. Betty De Silva is up next. RTE 2FM.